Ho, ho, ho. Merry winter times, Worst Foot Forward listeners. 'Tis the season to be jolly and joyous, watch festive films and crush your friends and family in end-of-year quizzes. So, in that spirit, join me, Barry McStay, nay Claus, and my co-host and little helper, Ben Vanderveld, for a Worst Foot Forward Christmas live stream. On 12th of December at 8:30pm GMT on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/@worstfootforward, you can join us for a Christmas quiz where you can win some Worst Foot Forward merch and a live watch-along of the cult Christmas anti-cracker Santa Claus Conquers the Martians. There'll be chat, mince pies, Christmas jumpers and lots of laughs. So subscribe to the YouTube channel, set a reminder on the stream, the link is in the description of this episode, and join us on Monday 12th of December at 8:30pm GMT for a quiz, a film and some festive Worst Footery. See you there. Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. This week, let me start with a question. Have you ever felt like this? Have strange things happened? Are you going round the twist? Well, not to worry, because one day we're going to get so high, because even the impossible is easy when we got each other. One day we're going to get so high, and at the end of the day, remember the days when we were close to the edge, and wonder how we made it through the night. The end of the day, remember the way we stayed so close till the end, and all the lives we ever lived and all the lives to be are full of trees and changing leaves. We'll remember it was me and you, because we are going to be forever you and me. We will always keep me flying high in the sky of love. And be honest, folks, given we're doing a show about the world's worst lighthouse, it is a crying shame and a real comment on my cultural deadening that the first two lighthouse-adjacent things I could think to quote were the theme song to Australian haunted lighthouse-based children's show Round the Twist and the 1997 international smash hit High by the Newcastle pop duo The Lighthouse Family, and not something from Virginia Woolf's modernist masterpiece To the Lighthouse, a book voted among Time Magazine's 100 best novels of the last 100 years. And it's even more shameful that I actually did quote Virginia Woolf in the middle of those Lighthouse Family lyrics, and you didn't even notice, you absolute Philistines. And alongside me is my co-host, always the big bad to my Virginia Woolf, Ben Vanderveld.
What's that hiding under your bed?
I was really thrilled to discover that I could find a quote from To the Lighthouse that fits so seamlessly into into the Lighthouse Family's lyrics.
I think that's a comment both on the asinine nature of their lyrics and the empty nature of Virginia Woolf's stream of consciousness. I'm an absolute philistine when it comes to Virginia Woolf. I'm sure she's very good indeed, but I remember being bored to tears by her when doing my GCSE English.
GCSE is a bit early to be reading
it.
Virginia
is a little
Woolf,
bit
I reckon.
Full on. I also,
but perfect for listening to The Lighthouse Family and watching Round the Twist.
I mean, The Lighthouse Family and Round the Twist are really the opposite ends of the lighthouse spectrum, aren't they?
But both, they really are.
Both of which formed a huge part of my childhood. Like, obviously, Round the Twist, seminal series for anyone in these islands, and obviously Australia, and I presume New Zealand.
I don't know if it reached America, but in terms of theme songs from TV shows you remember vividly and that you go, actually, they were bangers, that is, it's up there with DuckTales.
It is, but it's also one of those things where that is dislodged vital disk space from my brain.
Yeah.
You
yes.
know, do I know how to bleed a radiator? No. Do I know if I ever felt like this, a strange thing's going, then I'm going around the twist? Yes, till my dying day. And then The Lighthouse Family, by all metrics, I should dislike their inoffensive beige middle manager friendly pop. And yet that song hit a real sweet spot of young Ben's teenage angst,
just at the right impressionable age,
just at the right,
they imprinted on you.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, in my mental vinyl filing system, I've made sure it's between like Stockhausen and Frank Zappa, so they're not they're not comfortable in my head, but they are there.
That song was number one in Australia, so clearly Australia love a lighthouse.
Yeah, good Geordie lads, them Jimmy Nail and Lindisfarne. It's a hell of an afternoon at an underwhelming festival.
Yeah, very much so.
We should welcome our guest this week, who amongst many things is, in her words, renowned amongst her friendship group as a lighthouse expert / obsessive. She has so many strings to her bow that it is basically a harp. She has published...
Hang on, I do want to point out the bow isn't the instrument.
Yeah, you don't play a harp with a bow.
And you don't bow a harp.
Bow is... It's a mixed metaphor, Ben, that just doesn't work at all. But, I mean, good go, though. Well done, you.
Thank you very much. I really like the fact that I have yet to introduce you as a lecturer and you've already got the red pen out and are circling what I'm saying. When I say strings to... like, I presume that the bow in strings to your bow is a bow from a bow and arrow. Or is it the bow from a cello or violin? Because if it's bow to a bow and arrow, you add a few strings to that, you got yourself a basic harp.
Oh, do you know that's... Because actually, you know, on a violin bow, it's horsehair, isn't it? And it's not strings. Yeah. So you might be right. I'd always thought of it as a bow, as in violin bow.
What if it's a bow in like a really fancy gift shop, like the shop where Alan Rickman buys the present for Emma Thompson in Love Actually?
They don't have strings.
But they've added, you know, those ones where they do the bow, but then they add like artisanal... It's twine they put in those like fancy shops.
Right, okay. She has so much horsehair to her bow that she could run in the Grand National.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Jane Hill is actually one of the segments of the Aintree Racecourse.
The one, is the Grand National the one where the horses get killed?
Yeah. Yes, the winner gets to live.
I would be the one where they all just finally meet there.
This is the Jane Hill on which I'm going to die.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
Two things. Firstly, I would absolutely watch the Grand National every year if it was reimagined as Battle Royale, but for horses, which is essentially what it is. Secondly, I think we can all agree, since we've heard her voice, we've heard her name, I can dispense with the rest of the introduction.
No, sorry, please. I'll attempt to get this back
Googled
on track.
You've just haven't Googled me, Ben, have you?
I have Googled you thoroughly.
Hang on, let's let Ben complete the introduction and see how much of this makes the edit.
Yeah. This is all making the edit. I will make sure. I'm going to drop so many callbacks to whatever we've spoken about in the past 120 seconds that you won't be able to rid this from the edit. She has previously lectured at Lincoln and Wolverhampton University and now lectures at Plymouth Marjon University. And I cannot get out of my head that that isn't the Chinese game with the tiles. She teaches radio journalism and production, and most importantly of all, is a superb stand-up comedian. I first met her when fighting tooth and nail for the crown of North Essex New Comedian of the Year. Did you win? I think you won.
No, I came joint second with Andrew Doyle.
Formerly of this parish and now of the moral vortex that is GB News. Thankfully, our guest is here to balance the scales. She is very much the Lewis Lane of the comedy industry. It's a delight to welcome Jane Hill.
Thank you, Ben. What a great introduction that was.
Who's Lewis Lane?
Yeah, I was wondering that. I thought that was like, you mean Lois Lane, yeah?
I'm delighted to enjoy, I think, my second, perhaps third correction of the podcast.
I thought for a second that you'd gone very Geordie for that one word. You have to say Lewis.
Okay.
Or that you were just kind of being gender neutral or something.
I could have been. I mean, Jane, firstly, can I ask, is it possible to turn your sub-editing function off?
No, I'm really sorry. I'll try to. Yeah, to be fair, it wasn't me who picked up on Lewis Lane.
I think the problem is when you present a podcast about sort of facts and trivia and things like that, you get listeners who are very into the trivial and the pedantic, and they will all be sitting at home going, why didn't anyone pick Ben up on that?
I mean, Lois, I have never ever used that pronunciation. Then again, it's like the women's name, I can't even say it, Naomi.
Naomi?
Yeah, Naomi.
Naomi.
Yeah, just stick in another vowel sound, Naomi.
Naomi.
Or Naomi.
We've had a Naomi as a guest on the show before. Did I introduce Naomi? Did you make me introduce Naomi so you didn't have to do it?
I think I might have done. I'll be honest, it's a weird disability. It's niche. I don't get any funding for it. But I just, I like mispronouncing women's names. Anyway, Jane, okay. Hello.
Hello.
I'm guessing you're looking for conciseness in journalism, aren't you? So do you find that helps with stand-up comedy as well, to make what you do pithy?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, my own experience as a journalist dates back to doing radio. So I was a radio journalist for years, and then a boss. And radio is all about being really pithy, writing really short stuff, getting to the point really quickly. But I think increasingly with podcasting, for example, I think getting to the point quickly has become not necessarily the thing that what people want to do. So I think it's an interesting time to be teaching journalism, particularly multimedia journalism. And, you know, my sort of thing that I mostly teach is radio and television journalism and podcasting. And I'm just trying to get my head around things like TikTok and Instagram videos and stuff. So it's a whole, it's changing. And I don't think being pithy is quite what it used to be, because people seem to spend a lot more time watching or listening to stuff online, whereas stuff they wouldn't have the patience to watch or listen to in a linear format.
I suppose then the question is, why are your interest in lighthouses? I suppose it's a lovely difference from the fast-paced life of journalism to the quite, you know, regulated and generally quiet existence of lighthouses and lightkeepers.
Well, I think this is where I probably need to come clean. Some years ago, about 15 years ago, my aunt, who's no longer with us, my aunt and I used to be on kind of about 10 quid present giving relationship. You know, we'd each buy each other a birthday present. And one year my mother phoned to say, look, Marlene, that's my aunt, she wants me to let you know that she spent a lot more than she usually does on your birthday present, because she saw something that was so absolutely perfect for you that she had to buy it. It's just that she couldn't not buy it for you because it's so completely you. So I was quite excited and interested. See, I don't know what my aunt has got me. And what arrived in the post was a very hefty A4, you know, like one of those kind of heavy, bendy paperback books, kind of A4 format. Mm. When I opened it up, it was the complete guide to lighthouses of the United Kingdom. I had never indicated any interest in lighthouses whatsoever. And I sort of phoned my mum for an indication of what I was supposed to say. And I said, do you know what Marlene sent me? She sent me this book about, and she said, yes, I know. She told me, she said, oh, Jane's always been so interested in lighthouses. And she said, I didn't have the heart to tell her that I think she's got the wrong person. So she sent me, and what it was an incredibly detailed technical guide, literally, you know, like specifications, light strength, history of every single lighthouse in Great Britain. And I was in this kind of internet forum at the time with a lot of people I'm still friends with, mostly Americans. And I kind of told the story of this lighthouse book. And since then, I mean, literally 15 years later, if any of them goes to a lighthouse or sees a lighthouse, they will send me, they will tag me in any photo of a lighthouse. The thing is, if I had kept the book, you'd think I absolutely would be an expert on lighthouses, but I literally eBayed it the next day. The book cost 40 quid. I got something like £25 for it. So amazing. I wasn't out, you know, I actually did quite well birthday present wise. But since then, it's always like, lighthouses have kind of called to me.
Oh, they're meant to do the opposite. You're meant to go away from them.
Yeah, thank you. And now I live in Plymouth, and Plymouth, its very symbol is a lighthouse. Mm. You know, as you drive into Plymouth, on the road signs, the first thing you see is a lighthouse. It just seemed like I was always destined to live in a city that was represented by a lighthouse. You know, like my whole life has been leading to this moment. So when you mention lighthouses as a subject to talk about, I thought this has got my name on it.
You know, normally in these sort of situations, people have an albatross around their neck, but you have gone for a slightly different nautical symbol.
I have a lighthouse around my neck. Yeah, I mean, I could wear a lighthouse necklace. I could start a religion or something. But lighthouses, I mean, there's an extra significance. You know, when you're a kid, you share a bath with your brothers and sisters. Mm. So I've got an older brother and an older sister. And so at about 4, you know, you're sharing a bath, and it's when you start to notice the differences between boys and girls. My mother used to say, oh, look, Stephen's got a lighthouse and you've got a money box.
Good Lord.
See, when my aunt said, oh, Jane's always been interested in lighthouses, the whole thing just took on a different complexion as well.
It really, really makes Radio 4's financial advice program Moneybox Live take on a whole different complexion as well, doesn't it?
Well, they're the progenitors of Babe Station. You know, it's a four-year-old, unless he's having one of those unfortunate kindergarten stiffies. That's not a lighthouse, it's a submarine.
Well, you would think, but we always thought, oh, that's nice, it's got a lighthouse, and not only does he have the lighthouse, he's got the little buildings around it.
Listen, Jane, we always ask our guests what they are the worst at in the world. What is that for you?
I was going to say playing the violin, but I bet a lot of people said that. But then I asked the man who probably knows me best, and I said, Rob, what am I worst at in the world? And he said cycling.
Oh.
And I am a real, well, I mean, I've just... freakishly bad and scared and absolutely terrified of cycling.
When we did the very first episode of this, we did what we are worst at in the world. I too am abysmal at cycling, and it's taking us 250 episodes to find.
You know when you do cycling proficiency? So we all had to do cycling proficiency at junior school, and the idea is you do it in your last year at junior school so that when you go to secondary school you can cycle to school. We had only bought me a bike like the week before because I was known for just being, I was good at, you know, scooters. I was great at scooters. Uh-huh. My brother and I had a scooter stunt club. Don't say that carefully. I was good on the scooter, but cycling. So I kind of learnt to cycle, and everyone passes their cycling proficiency badge with like 80% or 90%. And they gave me 57%. And the man said to me, I'm only passing you because we've never had a fail yet. And then I didn't cycle again until I was 16. And then, you know, sixth form at school. My school was about a mile and a half from home. But, you know, mum said, well, let's get your bike and get back on the bike, cycle to school. And, well, I mean, I fell off in the middle of like a massive dual carriageway once in Portsmouth because I ran over a stone. And also, you know, when it's raining and you have to wear a cagoule, and the back of my cagoule kept getting caught to the behind the seat of my bike. So every time I stopped at traffic lights and went to stand up, the bike fell over.
Oh, no.
When I went to university, I was at university in London. My second year, I was living up in Golders Green. And at that point, you could get travel allowance. So it was eras of full student grants. But also, if you spent more than 50 quid on your travel, you could get the money back. And I worked out that a season ticket on the tube to get in, or the cost of getting from Golders Green to Euston every day, would cost me 250 quid. So I worked out if I use my bike, I would make £200.
Yes. Okay?
I could claim for my ticket and cycle. And so I would somehow cycle up Finchley Road. And there's a bit where the Hendon Way goes off to the left and you have to get across to the centre lane to carry on up to Golders Green. And my God, I don't know how I survived. I was absolutely terrified the whole time. I must have done it about five times and decided to stop cycling again. And then when I met Rob, he's a mad keen cyclist, you know, proper serious cyclist. He said, well, let's get your bike and we'll get you out there cycling again. And you know, in like love's first flush, you kind of do the things that your partner loves doing. Every time I'd be on a tiny little back street, and if a car passed me, I would wobble so much I'd have to get off and stop. So the last time I saw my bike, we were hurling it into a skip.
Oh, wow.
And I'm very happy now to say I will never cycle again. Oh, just, it's not going to happen.
Not even in a race against Ben.
Not even in a race against Ben. Sorry, Ben. I mean, we could try it, but I would just wobble and fall off my cagoule when we'd get caught to the seat.
Hit up Patreon, folks. If we get to 100 donations, maybe we can coax Jane out of retirement. This week's episode is a Patreon-sponsored episode. Thank you to our donor, Ailish Phillips, who has donated to the podcast at a level sufficient to request a topic. And our topic that she requested was World's Worst Lighthouse. We found the perfect lighthouse expert in Jane. I've coincidentally written a play set in a lighthouse. So we're going to start off with Ben, who's got to flash his credentials now as bright as a Fresnel lens.
The nearest I've got is that I once did a gig as a fundraiser for lifeboat men in colour coats in Newcastle, where you could see a lighthouse from the room in which I was dying. And I tried to sail towards it and it did not work.
That's so cruel, having a beacon of hope within eyeline while that was happening.
So I went all over the shop with what I found. So do you know what lighthouse keeper's nickname is? You know how like electricians are sparkies and carpenters are chippies
They're not lighties, are they?
They're not lighties. I feel like, Jane, this is me doing my best Magnus Magnusson on Mastermind.
I'm staying quiet at this point because, despite having been on Mastermind, not on the subject of lighthouses, incidentally, I just dropped that in, I don't know the answer to this one, and I ought to, I feel.
They're called wikis.
Oh, of course they are.
Yeah.
Because they kind of keep the wick, don't they?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, fair. Okay.
It was always candles for lighthouses back in the day.
It was doing that, replenishing the oil, buffing and polishing the lenses. Mm-hmm. It's, I mean, there's a lot of upkeep required. Mm. Obviously, you have to be of a particular psychological makeup to want to go and do such a challenging job, often very isolated, but also very often it would be families that would do it, and it would be handed down from father to son. Quite a lot of female lighthouse keepers as well, either sort of in an unattributed role because they were wives of the male lighthouse keeper. When do you think the first female lighthouse keeper in the United States was appointed?
I'm going to say around 1860.
Barry?
Yeah, I was just going to go just after the Civil War.
1776.
Wow, straight away.
Straight
away.
So that
would have been like an oil lampy candle lighthouse back in the day, because that's pre-electricity, she says.
It was.
That's extraordinary.
It really is, isn't it? A woman called Hannah Thomas, after the death of her husband, and given the anecdote you told earlier about your brother, the wonderfully named and appropriately named John Thomas, she took over at the Plymouth Gurnet Lighthouse in Massachusetts. She received $200 a year, which is a pretty solid wage. When there are lighthouses that are people's manned by men.
That might be the appropriate word for it,
It might be. Staffed just feels a little bit antiseptic and corporate, doesn't it?
Or like there's a butler and a chambermaid.
Personnelled.
The lighthouse scullery maid.
What do you think the nickname for a lighthouse that is manned by only one man?
A madhouse.
It is said to be a stag light.
Oh, of course, yes. I mean, imagine that they're... I mean, it's not like they're going to be having stag parties there, I would hope. Although I imagine a lot of alcohol would be taken.
Oh, yeah.
By a solo lighthouse keeper.
A lot of them did arts and crafts. There was a particular, like, Irish lightkeepers, they do a lot of painting and poetry and, like, crochet and stuff. And then they'd, like, bring gifts from lighthouse to lighthouse when they were stationed in a different one. There was a whole trade in it.
I mean, to be fair, poetry, I think that's just being the state of being Irish, isn't it?
Yes.
writing poetry.
Irish and staring out at sea all day.
Yes. What else are they going to do? Yeah. I was thinking of whittling. For some reason, I just imagine lighthouse keepers whittling.
Making spoons and things.
Yes. Lots of spoons, you know, or scrimshaw. I'm kind of quite I know scrimshaw isn't lighthouse people at all, it's like whalers, but I'm like really fascinated by scrimshaw. You know, the using whalebone to make the most elaborate kind of objects. It's like an amazing art form.
I think scrimshaw is a good name for a character who run a lighthouse. The United States Lighthouse Establishment, who is the precursor to the Coast Guard, they had like a little portable library which they would sort of take round to lighthouses. And it's just this little wooden cabinet. On the insides of each door, there's a reading list of what the library offered and a travel log detailing which lighthouses the library has been at and how long the library has spent there.
Oh, wow, that's really sweet. Yeah, I mean, what would be the equivalent now? Just kind of a list of podcasts to listen to, I guess.
Well, that's sort of like the perfect place to broadcast from, just the...
Oh, God, the transmitter you could get at the top of a lighthouse would be amazing. Oh, although, obviously, half of it, at least half of it, would be out to sea. And if it was on a peninsula, you would be mostly kind of broadcasting to an audience of confused dolphins.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you should say that. The first long-distance radio experiments that Marconi carried out, he used lighthouses as his receiver points. He worked a lot in South Foreland Lighthouse in Dover. And his first ship to shore transmission was there in 1898. Yeah, and he moved then to the west coast of Ireland, and so he built specialised radio stations. But originally, he used the lighthouses for exactly the reasons you're saying, for them to be, you know, prominent high points and things.
So the first metric that I looked for was just like what is the most remote lighthouse? Like, that might be very appealing to some people, but for me, no thank you. And it is an Icelandic lighthouse called the Þrýðrangavíti Lighthouse. It is about 4.5 miles off the southwest coast of Iceland in the archipelago known as Vestmannaeyjar. Both of those, of course, are Sigur Rós songs. And Its name just means the three rock pillars, because that's it, its location. It's pretty new. It's only about 80, 85 years old. It's only accessible by helicopter. But my favourite fact about it is that the chap who directed the building, Arne G. Podarinson, A, had to recruit experienced mountaineers to scale the rock on which it was located. And wow. To get to the top and finish it, their mountaineering tools weren't good enough to bite into the rock. So to get to the very top, they had to make a human pyramid and they had to clamber over each other to get to the top like Icelandic Oompa Loompas.
Oh, wow.
The sort of golden age of lighthouse construction is sort of 1700 to 1840, and they really blossom from, like, you know, 30s or 40s in America and Europe. And unsurprisingly, the Scandinavians are the forerunners in that, to, you know, 1,000, 1,500, 2,000, just a huge amount of them.
A lot in Norway. There's a lovely one, I think it's on the southernmost tip of Norway, that's just, like, really beautiful. It's one of the most photogenic lighthouses there is.
I suppose when you have a shoreline that's got so many wobbly bits.
Yes, the fjords.
Thanks to Slarty Bartfast.
Yes. I was trying to remember his name as you said that.
Yes.
I looked for a different metric. Obviously, the magnificent thing with lighthouses is their height. They are an incredible thing to look at. So I looked for the smallest lighthouse I could find. Aww. There are two contenders. There is the Strombolicchio Lighthouse in Italy. It is on the summit of a sea stack that is 1 nautical mile high. However, this lighthouse is only 8 metres high.
The sea stack is doing a lot of the work there, isn't it?
Yeah, yes.
I mean, it would be redundant to have it any higher, I guess.
Yeah, imagine having a 150-foot-tall lighthouse on top of that.
I mean, it would be so high that it wouldn't really illuminate that bit of the coast, would it? It'd be like there's some physics or maths angle there, isn't there, going on?
Oh, yeah, it'd be dispersed too much, probably.
Yes. As you can tell, I'm an expert physicist in mathematics.
When you were a child, your godmother left you a book about bulbs.
The other one is one that we could all visit when we next go to the Fringe, because the world's smallest working light tower is in North Queensferry. And it was built by Robert Stevenson, part of the North Queensferry Town Pier. So it looks over the Firth of Forth. If you want to climb to the top of it, you have to ascend a mighty 24 stairs.
Oh, okay. It's small then. It's like the size of maybe twice an average, because it's about 13 stairs, isn't it, up an average
flight. Yes.
Flight. Yeah. So okay, it's like two flights of stairs, basically.
Because when you said Stevenson, I just envisaged it was a failed train chassis that he just stuck a bulb on top of and went. lads.
Robert, not George.
Yes, sorry, yes.
I get really confused with my Stevensons, because then I start thinking of Robert Louis Stevenson.
Yeah.
And I don't think he built lighthouses, did he, in between writing
Treasure
Island and Poems for Kids?
Surprisingly, Jessica Stevenson does like building lighthouses in between acting gigs. Next looked up, just one that would be very unpleasant to live in Cleveland, Ohio. There's one next to Lake Erie, which is one of the Great Lakes. When it gets cold, the water spray from the giant waves freeze onto the lighthouse. Makes it impossible to be in. I mean, it's been unoccupied since 1965, because it's become automated, like a lot of them are. But it looks absolutely remarkable.
They've also, about 10 years ago, certainly in Ireland, and I'm sure in other places around the world, they've discontinued foghorns in much of the lighthouses and other posts around the coast, because so much of the machinery on boats now is so good that it's kind of unnecessary. But I say it's unnecessary until that those automated stuff fails. Then you're left wishing there was a foghorn.
I don't think there's any manned ones left in the UK. There was one on Fair Isle in Scotland that was manned up to the late 1990s. But they still have lighthouse keepers, you know, they still officially have lighthouse keepers who are kind of, I guess, responsible for them.
Yeah, and they do need cleaning, as Ben said. And cleaning them it's a whole dangerous thing, or certainly it was in the days when they were still using oil in a lot of them. Because, you know, the tiniest bit of oil, like, or grit in the lens, and you had the lens angled the wrong way on a sunny day while you were inside it cleaning, you could ignite. So you had to make sure it was angled the right way, you were cleaning it the right way.
The National Trust Twitter feed just today posted this morning a kind of picture of a weird pair of glasses. kind of little dark round lenses and little leather bits around the side. And it's like, guess what these are? And they were a lighthouse keeper's glasses to wear while cleaning the windows, because it kind of blocked the glare really thoroughly. And it just coincidentally, as the day we're talking about lighthouses, I spotted this tweet with a picture of the glasses.
A couple of lighthouse-related deaths. Always good to get them in. Henry Hall, the chap who was a lighthouse keeper of the Eddystone Lighthouse in Cornwall on December the 3rd, 1755. A fire broke out.
Oh, is it in Devon or Cornwall? This is a very hot subject, by the way, Ben, because I can actually see it from Plymouth Hoe on a clear day.
Oh, can you?
We might come back to that, but listen, carry on. Sorry, it's your podcast. Carry on.
As a secular cultural Jew, I prefer not to get involved in discussions of border disputes, even if it comes down as uncontroversial as Devon and Cornwall. In Devon and Cornwall, there's a debate about whether you put the cream on first on a scone, whereas between Jews and Palestinians, it's whether you put the hummus on first. the fire broke out. And he and his two companions tried to put out the fire. They failed. They escaped to the rocks outside the lighthouse and then watched it burn down. The next morning, they were all rescued. 2 days later, he died suddenly, despite showing signs of improvement. And people were like, my God, is this a curse? What's happened? This is terrifying. There was an autopsy performed after his death, and it revealed that while looking up the burning lighthouse, a piece of molten lead fell into his mouth and burned its way through his esophagus and ended up in his stomach.
Oh, my. Oh. That's just awful.
Yeah.
Oh, horrific. Just by the way, Eddystone Rocks, the nearest land point is Cornwall, but the rocks actually fall within the city limits of Plymouth. So it's within the county of Devon. I thought it was like Plymouth's, you know, Plymouth's lighthouse. But that's horrific. The lead thing, that's horrific.
Yeah, it is. The way you said that, it's the same sort of technicality whereby the Falkland Islands belong to us, but the Argentina are going, they should be ours, whereas technically the closest bit of land to them is Chile. Which is a piece of information no one wants to know.
No.
A little mystery before we get on to my choice. Have either of you heard of the Flannan Isles?
Are they in Ireland?
They're off the coast of Scotland. Like, obviously, okay. Nearby, but I think they belong to Scotland.
They belong to Plymouth.
Notoriously expansionist Plymouth.
Yes. And, until a rabbi brings a chickpea there, and then they're ours, all ours. So they have been uninhabited since the lighthouse on the largest island, Eileen Moore, was automated. But the lighthouse there used, obviously, to be inhabited, and it's the site of a famous mystery in 1900, when all three lighthouse keepers disappeared simultaneously without trace. There was a terrible storm which wrecked one of the two landings scheduled on the island, and it caused severe damage to equipment and infrastructure. Turf had been ripped away on the cliff, suggesting that there had been huge waves on the island. So the theory is that one giant wave must have swept all three of them away. But that doesn't make any sense, because there's no real reason why all three of them would have left the lighthouse. And particularly because when people went to check out the lighthouse, everything else was neatly arranged inside it except for one overturned chair at the kitchen table. The Northern Lighthouse Board rules were that the lighthouse should never be left unattended. And another strange detail was that a set of oilskins had been left behind, which suggests that one of the lighthouse keepers had rushed outside in such a great hurry that he hadn't bothered to prepare. So probably two guys got swept away and the third tried to go look for them and he got swept away as well. Yeah. But we'll just never know.
I just assume that at least one lighthouse keeper will go mad in any given period. Yes. So I think obviously one knocked his chair over and ran outside without his oilskins on in a fit of lighthouse-related madness, and the other two put oilskins on, went out to try and rescue him, or one went out first and the other one did. Yeah, and they all got washed out to sea. Quite clearly, that's the only explanation.
The Marie Celeste hovered over the lighthouse, beamed them up, and took them to the Bermuda Triangle.
Where they are now parting with Elvis and Lord Lucan.
Yeah.
For my nomination for the world's worst lighthouse, we're going to go to Sweden, or maybe Finland, or maybe Russia.
Or Plymouth.
Or Plymouth. Or the Plymouthian Empire starts here. So there is a little Nordic island called Market or Merkit. I don't know how you pronounce a Swedish A with two dots over it.
Meerkat?
Yes, Meerkat Lighthouse, which is obviously the most appropriate animal for lighthouses because they are little furry lighthouses themselves.
They're very well insured.
Yes. In the 19th century, when Finland was ruled by Russia, this island was uninhabited and it was divided between Finland and Sweden. But it also contributed to the sinking of 8 ships. Tsar Alexander III was like, right, I've had enough of this. I'm going to get an architect to build this lighthouse. And he ordered a Finnish architect to do that. And he did it on its highest point. Problem was that the highest point on this island belonged to Sweden. Even though the lighthouse was officially on Swedish soil, the Finns fought for it. And tensions flared between the two countries. And they couldn't resolve this until 1985.
Wow.
And only by the time it got to 1985, they were like, fine, we'll sort this out. And what they've done is they have basically gerrymandered the island and drawn a Z-shaped border along the island to accommodate the lighthouse.
I think we've mentioned that before with in our episode with Mark Cooper Jones about the world's worst country. We might have talked about land borders and weird looking borders. You're ringing a bell there. I've just had a little look at the island. It does have that, like, it does look like the Republican Party of Florida have drawn the voting boundaries on it. And my favourite part of that fact was you saying that it was responsible for the sinking of 8 ships. And you'd think at that, some point before that, people wouldn't need the lighthouse. They'd just go, oh, let's remember that island's there. But nope.
There's one thing we can all agree on is the main purpose of a lighthouse. Okay. I mean, broadly speaking, a lighthouse's purpose is to save lives by steering sailors from dangerous coastline.
I think that's a good baseline.
A really important thing about the lighthouse is the location. My contribution to the world's worst lighthouse is the Cape St. George Lighthouse, and it's near Jervis Bay in Australia, south of Sydney. And the point about the lighthouse, it has killed more people than it's saved. And the reason for that is they built it in the wrong place. I know. So Jervis Bay is kind of a C-shaped bay.
The letter C,
Yeah, the letter C, yes. When I say C-shaped, I mean the letter C-shape. It's a sort of a serif C, so there's kind of bits on the end. That's kind of the shape of the bay. You know, there's a couple of peninsulas either side of the bay that you think might make sense. They decided, actually, the most dangerous bit of the coastline was just to the south of the southern bit of the C, the letter C. And it was decided to build a lighthouse there because there was a bit of rocky shoreline, and also they wanted to keep people away from the two bits that kind of bordered the bay. 1860, they decided to build it, and they came up with architect Alexander Dawson. Now, he had built the Sydney Observatory before then, so he was a well-known architect. There's a thing called the Pilots Board, or there was in Australia, which was like the controlling authority, like Trinity House, you know, the controlling authority for lighthouses. They weren't consulted about the choice of architect. £5,000 was allocated, and so it all started. So obviously the Pilots Board had to decide where to build it. And there was a proposed site, and they actually said, look, the map is really, really vague. The map suffers from discrepancies of so grave a character that it is impossible to decide whether either position marked on the map actually exists.
Never a good starting point.
They also asked this question. They said, that point where you're planning to build it, is that really the best? Will it actually be visible from either direction? Nobody really could make up their mind. So anyway, work started. It was commissioned, and it was actually started to be built around 4 kilometres north of where it should be. The reason it was built about 4 kilometres north of where it should be was the contractor said, well, that was a lot closer to the quarry where he got the stones from. And it was easier to get the stones from the quarry to that point than it was to get them to the actual point where the lighthouse needed to be built. So by the time the lighthouse was built, it couldn't be seen from the northern approach. and it could barely be seen from the southern approach either. It was kind of pointless. And during the 39 years it took for this to be rectified, they've listed at least 13 shipwrecks. Oh. So this is the official record of the number of shipwrecks. However, in fact, there were 23 ships wrecked somewhere on the south coast of New South Wales around Jervis Bay during this 30-year period from 1860 to 1899. 1899, they finally said, look, this is ridiculous. We need to kind of change the position. They decided to build it actually on the kind of northern edge of the letter C shape, a place called Point Perpendicular. Much more suitable for a lighthouse, you know, on a kind of a narrow spit of land, very clearly on the edge of something. You know, you couldn't possibly argue with where that was. The only thing is they didn't take away the existing one. They took the light away, but the other tower still remained. And in daylight or on moonlit nights, you could see the light from Point Perpendicular. But the way, if you're approaching from the south, you could also see the other lighthouse building.
Oh,
and you
no.
couldn't tell, under certain light effects, where the light was coming from. So it wasn't until about 5 years later that they finally... Well, what they did to start with was they actually... The Australian Navy used it for target practice. And eventually it was destroyed. It is now just a pile of rubble. But basically, it was a lighthouse that caused more shipwrecks. You know, it actually cost more lives than it would have saved. Not just that, there were also a whole series of, like, really weird deaths connected with it. So one child of one of the lighthouse keepers actually lost his... He was pushing rocks around, fell off into the sea. The assistant lighthouse keeper, William Markham, at one point got kicked in the head by a horse and died before he could get to hospital.
It was his fault for trying to get a horse up the stairs in a lighthouse.
Horses do not like lighthouses. They do not mix.
No, isn't that a Spanish tradition?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, the running of the horses up the lighthouse. Yeah.
Another of the lighthouse keepers was washed off the rocks while fishing. It was eaten by sharks as his son looked on. I mean, the whole lighthouse just is responsible for so many.
It's the most Australian death ever, that.
It is. I mean, I did look at others. I did think about the Statue of Liberty, because I don't know if you know that at one point there was a short period where it was decided that the Statue of Liberty could double as a lighthouse, and they would put the light in the little crown.
It had a lot of sort of alternate lives. Yeah. I mean, it was meant to be at this entrance to the Suez Canal, but they wanted to put it in the crown, not in the hand.
Yeah, I don't think it really worked in the hand, so they thought about it in the tiara. But they did realise that basically it would only shine, it wouldn't even go as far as Manhattan. You know, it just wouldn't be bright enough. And so it shone for about a week as a lighthouse. Nobody wanted it as a lighthouse, but it was just like, well, we've got this statue. Hey.
Can you imagine her going in for an interview? Lady Liberty, I just noticed there's like this one thing on your CV. You left this job after 1 week. Do you want to explain that gap
expensive.
In your resume?
Expensive, difficult to light, no actual good as a navigational aid, no amplifying lens in the torch. The light was very weak. But no, I thought I rejected that one because I think just conclusively, it was never built as a lighthouse. A thing that was built as a lighthouse to save lives in the wrong place entirely. Couldn't even be seen from the approaches to the bay. 23 shipwrecks in the 30-year period that it was there.
But the fact that they took that long to decide they needed to do something about it. But I thought you were going to say they moved it, because there's cases of lighthouses being moved.
Well, I mean, the lighthouse sits on... I'm sorry to go back to Plymouth, but the lighthouse sits on Plymouth Hoe, Smeaton's Tower, was the old Edderstone lighthouse. So, you know, there's been a number of different lighthouses on Edderstone Rock. And so they moved one. Now, you could say that Smeaton's Tower in Plymouth Hoe is completely useless as a lighthouse in that it doesn't light up and it doesn't do anything.
Have they just moved it to the land as like a tourist attraction?
Yeah, it is literally just as a symbol of the city. It just sits there on the Hoe and it is open at certain times, but I've never really been able to work out when. Yeah. Every time I go to go up the lighthouse, it's closed.
Because there's the Bell Toot lighthouse at Beachy Head, and it was moved in 1999. 17 metres back from the edge of the cliff, not because it was about to jump, but because the cliff was about to erode under it and make it fall in. Cost £250,000 to do it.
Mm.
There's another one in Denmark called the Ruberg Nude Lighthouse near Jutland. It's in shifting sand dunes. It was built in 1900, and it's an amazing photo. You can see photos of it where it's literally this lighthouse looks like it's in the middle of all of this sand. The coast there erodes on average 1.5 metres a year.
Wow.
There was a church built there called near Marup. It was built in 1250. The church was originally 1 kilometre away from the coastline, and it was dismantled in 2008 to stop it falling into the sea. So a whole kilometre of coast. So this lighthouse, they thought it was going to fall into the sea sometime next year, but they've decided to move it again at the cost of about 5 million Danish kroner, 720 tons of it, being moved inland. They've built rails. They've sort of lifted it, put it onto rails and moving it inland about 70 metres, which is supposed to secure the future of the lighthouse until 2060.
Which doesn't seem enough. It's a fine line, though, because if you move it too far inland, it comes absolutely pointless.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a lighthouse in Oxfordshire, officially.
Is there?
Yeah. So this is apparently the furthest lighthouse from the sea. I don't know whether it's in the UK or the world. There must be one. There must be like some folly inland in the States. It was built as a beacon. It's Farringdon Beacon. It's kind of between Swindon and Oxford. And during the sort of millennium celebrations, you know, when we had that chain of beacons around the country, apparently it was officially designated as a lighthouse in order to have this light in it for the millennium celebrations. You could say that Farringdon Folly is the furthest lighthouse from the sea and therefore the most pointless.
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to
You're going to
beat you there. So I just looked it up. Beedston Lighthouse in the Wirral Peninsula in Merseyside is 3.9 kilometres away from the coast. It was built in 1771, rebuilt in 1873, and used until 1913.
So it was actually built as a lighthouse as opposed to this place, which was designated lighthouse, I suppose, yeah. 3.8 kilometres inland.
But is it the physics? We're talking the physics again. It's like the angle that the light goes out.
Yeah, I guess so.
Everything.
Okay, I have to. I found a more landlocked lighthouse while we're here. Okay, I found a lighthouse in Nebraska.
Oh, well done. I knew there must be one somewhere like that.
Yeah.
Well, we've mentioned the Nebraska Navy before, being admiral in the Nebraska Navy, which is kind of a like a kind of jokey honorific that they give in the state. So this is appropriate they have a lighthouse to go with it, I guess.
Well, yeah, exactly. So it's in a place called Linoma on the eastern edge of Nebraska. It's next to a little lake. But not next to a lake where if there wasn't a lighthouse there, you'd be like, you know what, someone bloody better well build a lighthouse here, otherwise there'll be deaths.
The number of pedalos that go crashing onto the rocks. Very good. All right, but nowhere as picturesque as that. Instead, the Cape St. George Lighthouse in Sydney is Jane's suggestion. Some lighthouse terminology to start you off. The light isn't called a light, it's called an optic. In lighthouse terms, obviously magnified by a lens. Theatre people might know that Fresnel is a type of light used in theatre light. That Fresnel was a French inventor who also specifically designed that type of light. It's concentric circles of glass to help project lights in lighthouses, because it used less glass. If you slice the lens up and sort of set it in itself, rather than having sort of a big ball of glass to help amplify stuff, you had this flat pane with concentric circles in it, and helped amplify them much more effectively. The top bit of the lighthouse is called the lantern. That's the bit with the windows around. You don't really call them windows, they're called storm panes or glazings as well. The first known lighthouse is the famous one from the Seven Wonders, the Pharos of Alexandria in Egypt. Ptolemy the First and Second constructed about 300 BC, 450 feet high, and was destroyed in stages, it says here, by invaders and earthquakes, fully destroyed by the 1300s. But I just like the idea that every now and again someone would come and lop a story off it or something.
Yeah, the planning regulations kept changing. You know, they brought in like, no, sorry, it's too high.
It was like the Black Knight and Monty Python. They've just sort of lopped a head off. The oldest still existing lighthouse in the world is thought to be the one in La Coruña in Spain. Dates from about 20 BC. It's a Roman lighthouse. And similarly, there's a Roman lighthouse in the cliffs of Dover in the United Kingdom, which is now within the walls of Dover Castle, constructed about 40 AD. It's called the Dover Pharos, named after the one in Alexandria. And it's the most complete still standing Roman building in England, which is amazing. Like I said, there's only three of these Roman lighthouses still around. The two I just mentioned, and there's one in Libya as well. And the top of this one in Dover, it seems to have been angled in such a way that you could also communicate with a second lighthouse on Western Heights and another one on the French coast. So the Romans were sort of building little triangles of lighthouses, communicated with one another even at that point, and they would have had burning braziers, as you said. This one was helped to survive because they built a church next to it in the 11th century, and they incorporated this tower as the belfry for a period of time.
Oh, I do like a bit of recycling.
And there's the 800-year-old Hook Head in Ireland. There were records of in the 5th century, there's a Welsh monk apparently had a beacon on the peninsula in Hook Head to warn sailors, because it was a particularly dangerous part of the coast, a lot of shipwrecks. The current structure has stood for 848 years. And they used to have, as I said, they used to have foghorns. And in the days before foghorns, what they would have was they'd have a fog signal of guns being fired on the cliff edge every 10 minutes or so. Then they moved to explosive charges, which were on the top of the tower on an extending arm. And then finally the air horn or the hooter. And it's in Lonely Planet. It's in the top 10 flashiest lighthouses in Lonely Planet. And they described Hook.
When you say the flashiest lighthouses, do you mean flashy as in, hey, you know, showy? Yeah. Or like literally like they
brightness,
flash
yeah.
the most? Oh,
the
okay.
candelas. I don't know. Yeah, thought, you know. Well, that's interesting you said that as well, because they certainly in Ireland, I'm sure in other countries around the world, they're a bit like, you know, the way clowns register their face paint. The lighthouses are defined by the how their stripes are painted and what color,
really?
And also the pattern of their light flash. They all have a distinctive, certainly in Ireland, I'm sure it'll be the same in other countries, that the design and the pattern of the lights are all distinctive to different lighthouses, in case you were that lost.
Like, where are we? Oh, it's got a yellow lighthouse. We must be like miles away. So Smeaton's Tower on Plymouth Hoe is very distinctively red and white striped. And, you know, this whole symbol of the city, like the road signs, everything in the city, you know, the fridge magnet will always have it on. I can see it from near my flat. I can go out for a little walk and I can look across to the lighthouse. And yet there's a really famous photo from 1967 of the Beatles on Plymouth Hoe and the four Beatles sitting there looking at the lighthouse. And it's such a famous photo that on Plymouth Hoe, there's actually kind of moulds of the Beatles' bums, and you can sit where the Beatles sat. And I've always wondered if that's where Blur got the song Beetle Bum from, the Beatles' bums. But in the photo, the lighthouse is white. It used to be red and white, and then it was white. Apparently it has to be red and white if you're against white cliffs or something.
The Turnberry Golf Club, which has hosted the British Open golf multiple times, is now owned by the Trump family, so it's unlikely to hold the golf in any time soon. But I've been there. It's a beautiful golf course, and its most famous hole is the ninth hole is a par three, where you hit a tee shot right from on the edge of the sea, and it's towards a lighthouse, which is by the 10th tee box. It's beautiful. And I think that lighthouse has at various times been repainted, so you see different stagings of the golf, and the lighthouse is a different shade of yellow or whatever. Hook Head, which I mentioned, by hook or by crook, that phrase is one of the suggestions where that comes from. It might be related to that lighthouse. The phrase is first used in a tract from 1380. And one of the suggestions is that it came from travelling along the coast, either via Hook Head or the nearby village of Crook on land. And I also looked for what the tallest lighthouse in the world was, just out of curiosity. I mentioned the Pharos in Alexandria used to be 450 feet high. The current tallest lighthouse in the world is 436 feet high.
Wow.
It's in Jeddah. It's a really fascinating looking building. It's cylindrical at the top of it, and it's got an observation building and then a balcony, and then there's the light on top of it, because it's a bit like an airport control tower with an extra bit on top of it, because it does host the control tower for the port itself is also based in the lighthouse.
Yeah, I'm looking at pictures. It's like a stocky version of that tower in Berlin with the kind of the round bit on. That's what it looks like. But it kind of really weirdly deformed, doesn't it?
Yeah. I looked for lonely lighthouses as well, and I found 9.3 kilometres east of Ushuaia, which is the southernmost city in the world, is Les Éclaireuses, which is the lighthouse at the end of the world.
I looked that one up and then decided I couldn't pronounce it.
Yeah, it's on a rock. Basically, Tierra del Fuego and the mountains are in the background, and this rock out in the middle of the water with lots of seabirds on it, and so this little lonely lighthouse.
So that's like Chile or something, is it?
Yes, off the bottom tip of South America. There was one that I particularly wanted to read about, the Fastnet Lighthouse off the Irish coast. I have here with me the book The Lightkeeper by Gerald Butler, who was an Irish lighthouse keeper. As I mentioned, I've written a play set in a lighthouse, so I bought a lot of Irish lighthouse books at the time. He was a lightkeeper in various lighthouses, but particularly he was on Fastnet Rock. And Fastnet, it's amazing. It's another very stark location for a lighthouse. It's a rock 6.5 kilometres southwest off Cape Clear Island, 13 kilometres from County Cork on the mainland. It's the southernmost point of Ireland, this rock in the Atlantic Ocean. And Facet Lighthouse was 54 metres high on this rock. It's the second one to have been built on the rock. It's the tallest lighthouse in Ireland. There's been a lighthouse there since the 1850s on Ireland's Teardrop.
Mm-hmm.
It's the last part of Ireland that Irish emigrants would see before they were sailing to North America. So it has sort of very somber feel to it. And it gives its name to one of the areas of the shipping forecast that the BBC transmits as well. But it's most famously the midpoint of one of the world's classic offshore yachting races, the Fastnet Race.
Yes.
A 1,126-kilometre round trip from Cowes and the Isle of Wight around the rock and back to Plymouth.
Yeah, and the thing I'm really aware of is being a teenager on holiday in Devon. During the 1979 Fastnet Race, one of the worst yachting disasters, I think. You know, sorry to go so bleak, but it was just horrific. 15 yachtsmen and 4 spectators died in that huge operation. I mean, I just remember it dominating the news.
The 1979 race was the 29th, I suppose, sailing of this particular race. Very prestigious race. And it was that year, it was the climax of a 5-race cup, the Admiral's Cup. So it was big deal. And the winner, the handicap winner of the race, was the yacht Tenacious, owned and skippered by Ted Turner, who founded CNN. But as Jane said, it was a horrendous race that year. And there was a storm on the third day of the race, which there were 303 yachts started the race, 19 fatalities, as Jane said. Loads of yachts were destroyed. The emergency services, the naval forces, civilian vessels from both England and Ireland were summoned. 4,000 people were involved in the rescue, including the entire Irish Naval Services fleet, lifeboats, commercial boats, helicopters. It is the largest ever rescue operation in peacetime. And Gerard Butler, in this memoir of his, it's fascinating to read, he was a lightkeeper on the rock that day in August 1979 when disaster hit. And he says, a couple of quotes from it here, "As waves reached the rocks where we were standing, they would rise up 100 feet, completely obliterating any yachts below. The water looked like it was pressing the yachts down into the sea. All we could do was record what we were seeing, and over the radio we could hear the screams of people calling out for help, but no one could reach them."
Oh my goodness. Oh
God, that's heartbreaking.
They did their best to, you know, provide a beacon, but if the weather was just impossible to sail through for so many people. There have been commemorations of this in the last few years, obviously, because it's just past 40 years since the event. And the Irish poet Eileen Ní Chulainn wrote a poem called Fastnet, and these lines are particularly haunting, I think. "Only the man that minds the light, watching the great revolving spokes, hitting the piled castles of spray, can say, trapped, not able to save, this is life, I am living it now, here."
Ooh.
Pretty horrible lighthouse to have to inhabit.
Yeah.
But I'm not choosing that one just because it's so haunting. I couldn't not mention it, but instead I'm going for Terrible Tilly.
Okay.
Tillamook Rock Light was built on a rocky outcrop 2 miles off the coast of Oregon, built in the 1870s, I think. It was closed in 1957. And it was one of those places that, you know, the storms were outrageous. Fastnet, as I mentioned, was struck by a wave 157 feet high in the 1980s. Winds have been measured there at nearly 120 miles an hour. And Terrible Tilly basically had the same sort of thing. Storms once blew a rock of 135 pounds in weight up through the kitchen window of the lighthouse.
Good Lord.
And another storm managed to throw debris up to the lantern tower, destroying the light itself, severing the radio contact with the mainland. The keepers had to keep bricking up windows because they kept being broken. Eventually, they'd only have like little tiny peepholes to look outside. So obviously, that's even more horrifying to live in. It's basically this Rapunzel tower.
Dark.
Yeah, no light, no windows. Yeah. So they say they closed it in the 1950s. So the question was, what do you do with it? Lots of lighthouses have been turned into artist retreats and B&Bs and gallery spaces, all sorts of things. But they weren't sure what to do with it. There was questions about redevelopment. So it was abandoned for 20 years. And then in 1980, a pair of investors established Eternity at Sea Columbarium. Do you know what a columbarium is? It's the term for a repository for ashes.
That's where you kind of had them on shelves around kind of a...
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, like an ossuary, but for ashes rather than bones. And so they decided to set up the Eternity at Sea Columbarium at Tillamook Rock. You know, they'd cremate you and then they'd bring your urn out and store it in the lighthouse. Only problem being that the storms were still happening and it wasn't being tended by lightkeepers anymore. So the roof was leaky. There were rocks and debris and things still flying through it. The rock of the lighthouse is in a nationally protected wildlife area, which meant during the spring and summer breeding season for different birds, no human beings were allowed nearby as well. So the Eternity at Sea company, they couldn't go out there and maintain the lighthouse with any consistency.
Are you going to tell me that a lot of puffins have done their business in lots of people's granny's ashes?
Yep. They lost their columbarium license in 1999, and 30 urns are still inside the Tillamook Rock Light. Terrible Tilly has decided it's not fit for human living habitation, and now it's not even fit for the dead habitation. So our candidates this week for the world's worst lighthouse are Ben's suggestion of Market Island, the cause of wobbly borders and the anger of a czar. Jane's suggestion of Cape St. George Lighthouse near Sydney, the cause of 23 shipwrecks and the target for the Australian Navy. My suggestion of Terrible Tilly, a lighthouse not fit for living or the dead. I think I'm going to go with Jane's metric on this one, I think. In terms of a lighthouse that wasn't effective and was built in entirely the wrong place, and even when they tried to rectify it, it still was causing ships difficulty. A lighthouse so bad that the ships turned against it and the Navy destroyed it.
You're right.
I think it's a clear winner.
Yeah, I think Jane set out what she was trying to achieve and achieved it. It's inarguable.
You know, I felt the important thing is define what a lighthouse is for and then measure against the metric of its essential purpose.
It's the rigor of a lecturer and a newsreader that us two hacks couldn't bring. Before we go, I've got to give you some of the best news of the week. I typed in good news into Google, and Google suggested the good news that I should be reading about was like Bill Gates' daughter is pregnant. Literally,
fantastic.
The first five.
I'm genuinely so thrilled for her.
Then I realised that today is Friday, the 25th of November, when we're recording this. It's the Late Late Toy Show on RTE in Ireland tonight, my favourite annual TV viewing.
Oh, man.
But I had to find some actual good news. And so this comes from the Wildlife Trust. Wildcats are going to be released in England again for the first time in hundreds of years. Which feels like we're heading towards the end of days where people will just have to fight the cats for dominion of the land when the civilization begins to fall. But yeah, the European wildcat was hunted to extinction in the UK. It's the UK's rarest native mammal. Not really been spotted in southern England since the 16th century, but they're now looking into trying to introduce them in Devon and Cornwall. they're hiring wildcat officers, which is a great title, who'll be... you know, doing the studies to see if you can introduce them again. And they're just in remote Scotland, I think you can find them at the moment. I think they've got only about 30 wild animals in Scotland at the moment, and a lot of them are hybridized with domestic cats and so on.
Oh my God. So I mean, domestic cats are kind of horrific creatures at the best of times.
Yeah, I know.
You know, I mean, they're just in their kind of absolute disparagement of human beings.
Yeah.
And God, just imagine a crossbreed of a real cat and a wild cat.
Yeah. Well, I just really liked this quote from Derek Gow, who's a farmer turned rewilder in Devon. He says his hopes wildcats will be back by 2025. We want to do this responsibly, but we don't want to talk for 50 years and do absolutely bollocks all.
That's Devon for you.
So yeah, bit of good news. Just be careful what you pet in the coming years. Jane, if people want to find out more about you, where can they do that?
Well, I was going to say my website, but I think it's out of date, judging from Ben's introduction. I mean, at the moment, for the next couple of weeks, maybe, I'm clinging on to Twitter, at JaneHill64. But I have also set up an account on Mastodon with a similar address. I have no idea. I mean, God knows what's going to happen. So those are probably the best ways of keeping in touch with me. At some point, I might update my website, but websites are so like 10 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's probably Twitter for now, or Instagram. I'm on Instagram. Same address, JaneHill64. I put stuff up there sometimes. I put pictures of lighthouses up actually quite often. So
great.
You know, for all your lighthouse picture needs, mostly of Devon, actually mostly of Smeaton's Tower on Plymouth Hoe, once a week. That's the place to go.
Excellent stuff. Meanwhile, we're all off to set up an OnlyFans account where Ben will be posting pictures of his lighthouse. Thank you for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye.
Goodbye.